Falter-Podcasts werden durch Werbung unterstützt. Das hilft bei der Finanzierung unseres journalistischen Angebots.
Herzlich willkommen im Falter Radio. Sie hören Barbara Tod. Putins Einmarsch in die Ukraine bedeutet das Ende von Europa, wie wir es kennen. Europa, das war das große Versprechen, dass der liberale und demokratische Westen den Rest der Welt transformieren wird. Jetzt müssen wir fürchten, dass unsere Lebensweise durch ein imperialistisches Russland, durch dessen Angriffs- und Vernichtungskrieg und durch autoritäre Kräfte zerstört wird. Darüber spricht der Politikwissenschaftler Ivan Krastev mit meiner Kollegin Eva Kunzett. Krastev ist Permanent Fellow am Institut für die Wissenschaften von Menschen und Vorsitzender des Center for Liberal Strategies in Sofia. Das Gespräch fand am 30. März 2022 auf Englisch im Rahmen der Wiener Vorlesungen statt.
Herr Krastev, Sie müssen nicht lange vorgestellt werden. Sie sind einer der großen Intellektuellen Europas. Sie sind Osteuropa-Experte, Ratgeber inländischer und ausländischer Regierungen. Sie sind Kommentator in internationalen Medien. Und Sie haben etwas gemacht, was nicht viele von sich behaupten können. Sie haben nämlich Wladimir Putin, den russischen Präsidenten, getroffen bei einem Abendessen 2014 im Kreml. Mr. Krastev, you don't need a really big introduction. You are one of Europeans' great thinkers. You are an advisor to governments in Austria and also abroad. You are a writer in foreign media. And you have something that not so many people can talk about, because you have met Vladimir Putin personally during a dinner in the Kreml in 2014. Der 24. Februar 2022 wird in die Geschichtsbücher eingehen als jener Tag, an dem Russland nicht nur seinen Nachbarn die Ukraine überfallen hat, sondern als der Tag einer Zäsur. Dieser Krieg wird die Art und Weise verändern, wie Europa funktioniert, aber auch wie wir uns selber sehen. Haben wir denn schon verstanden, Herr Krastev, wie einschneidend diese Veränderungen sein werden? If we were ever asked ourselves what it is like to live historical events, February 24th, 2022 was the day. The day Russia invaded its neighboring country, Ukraine. It is the day that is certainly a breaking point for Europe, the way Europe functions and also the way it sees itself. Have we understood yet, Mr. Krastev, to which extent these Russian tanks and missiles crossing the border will change Europe and beyond?
No, I do believe that we're still starting to understand what is going on. Because what it means to go through a historical event, this is when you are telling your life to divide this before and after. In the way it was with the fall of the Berlin Wall. Listen, I remember the fall of the Berlin Wall. In the next 2 or 3 weeks, you're commenting a lot, but you don't understand exactly what is the scale of the change. And then with the passing of times, basically you divided your life on before and after the fall of the wall. And from this point of view, this war is going to be one more dividing line. It's going to be before and after. In a certain way, the period that started with the peaceful unification of Germany is now ending with the violent partition of Ukraine. And it is going to have a meaning, and this is going to affect the lives of people who even now just see this as a war that is happening somewhere else. It's going to change economies. This is going to change relations between people. But most probably it's going also to change the way we view Europe, because we knew one thing about Europe. And this was that, for good or for bad, Europeans, we have convinced ourselves that a major war is not possible here anymore. We knew that there was a war around, but we believe this is particularly European, that the major war is not possible here anymore. And then the impossible became possible. And don't forget that it comes after this 2 years of pandemics in which other things that we didn't expect happened. And for me, the biggest kind of a metaphor for what we're seeing is 2 years ago, if you go on the railway station, there was nobody. Go on the airports, they were totally empty. You have the feeling that nobody is moving. Everything had been frozen. And now you go on the railway station or airports, and you're going to see these crowds of people who are running, but they don't know where they're running, because their houses are behind them and they have been destroyed, and for them the life changed in the way that it's difficult to imagine. And this happened just in a period of 2 years. And this is why this is one of the things that is impossible to forget, but also not easy to tell.
Historiker sagen, dass es 30 Jahre braucht, dass man erst eigentlich nach 30 Jahren sagen kann, was wirklich passiert ist. Wir wollen aber trotzdem noch einmal zu diesem 24. Februar zurückgehen, dem Tag des Angriffs. Was haben denn Sie an diesem Tag gemacht? Historians say that it takes at least 30 years to look back on events and to really clarify what happened. But let's go back to February 24th. What have you done during the day, and what were your thoughts? What were you thinking?
Listen, one of the kind of a shock of what happened was that on one level, this was unthinkable. On the other level, it was predicted. In the last 2 months before the war, particularly the American intelligence was insisting that the Russian troops are preparing for a major military operation. So this is not that we didn't know that this is possible. And there was a lot of information about concrete movements of troops, about intercepted communication. But the story was, we were trying to convince ourselves that it was a bluff, that at the end of the day, even if they're going to something to happen, it will not get out of the Donbass and Donetsk regions, that in a certain way, we cannot imagine that they're going to be attacked on Kiev. And even if they're going to be attacked on Kiev, nobody is going to imagine the level of destruction, basically the Russian tanks and planes destroying cities in which most of the people speak Russian language. So from this point of view, this was a strange thing. You know that something is going to happen, but you're still not ready to believe it. And to be honest, it was true for us, it was true for the Russians. I do believe that most of the Russian publics, but also part of the pro-Putin elite, was as surprised of what happened as we were.
Warum haben wir die Augen so verschlossen? Wie konnte das passieren? How could we have turned such a blind eye on events that were obvious?
This is a strange story. And of course, this goes with everything good that happened for the last 30 years. Basically, we believe that we know that you are not going to achieve much with the war. The idea was what exactly you're going to gain, what you're going to prove. All the story was that people are just using the armies in order to make a point. And then we were kind of unprepared for this because, and this is particularly true for the Europeans, we always believed that the world is kind of populated with consumers who are never going to do anything that is going to destroy basically their usual way of life, that nobody is going to go for a war, because if you go for war, it's bad for tourism. If you go for war, it's bad for the economy. This understanding of the fact that people basically always are rational and very much in economic terms was very difficult to answer the question why somebody should go to do it. But the other story was that it was in a certain way so difficult to get it because we are talking about two countries that have so much shared history, people that share language. It is one thing to go and to bomb somebody that you have never seen in your life. It is as awful. People are dying. It's totally different when you're bombing somebody whom you know, with whom basically you have been in a common country just 30 years ago. So this is what makes the situation was so difficult and so unbelievable, while we knew all the information. And this was the difference, by the way, between the Americans and Europeans. Americans were not trying to read Putin's mind. The idea was Russia has enough troops on the borders and you're putting these troops in order to use them. While Europeans were trying to read his mind, and we said, no, he cannot do it. He's playing. He's an intelligence officer. He's trying to deceive us again. So now this is why the shock was so big, and I do believe that this is why the moral outrage was so incredible.
Wir werden nachher noch sprechen über dieses Konzept eines Handels als Sicherheitsnetz. Kommen wir aber noch ein bisschen in das Aktuelle hinein. Noch vor wenigen Tagen schien die Lage völlig aussichtslos. Russische Raketen bombten das belagerte Mariupol in Schutt und Asche. Die in Stadt gebliebenen beerdigten die Toten in ihren Vorgärten und Massengräbern. Gegen Kiew mehrten sich die Angriffe. Seit Anfang der Woche aber scheint Bewegung in die Verhandlungen gekommen zu sein. Die russischen und ukrainischen Unterhändler sprechen in Istanbul miteinander und da kommt irgendwie jetzt Bewegung hinein. Der russische Verhandler meinte am vergangenen Dienstagabend, dass Russland seine Angriffe unter anderem gegen die Hauptstadt Kiew drastisch zurückfahren würde, um Vertrauen aufzubauen. Jetzt meinten Sie in einem kürzlichen Interview, dass ein Bulgare schwer optimistisch gestimmt sein könnte. Trotzdem möchte ich Sie fragen, was sehen Sie in diesen Verhandlungen? Sehen Sie eher Hoffnung oder ein Täuschungsmanöver? We will talk about the concept of trade as a safety net for peace, but let's get back to what is actually happening right now. As doomy as the situation looked like a couple of days ago with the destruction in besieged Mariupol, with people burying their dead in their front yards and in mass graves, where we could see how Kiev came under attack, we see now maybe something like a silver lining. We see negotiations in Istanbul, and it was only yesterday when Russia has declared to drastically reduce its activities, especially in the outskirts of Kiev. Russia accordingly wants to build trust for future negotiations. You recently said in an interview never to ask a Bulgarian to be optimistic, but what do you see right now? Hope or bluff?
No, listen, in a certain way, we'll know the right answer in 1 month or 2 months. My feeling is that the Russian army is much more regrouping. They understood that capturing Kiev is going to be extremely costly, both in terms of the soldiers' life on the Russian side, but also in terms of the reputation of the Russian Federation. At the same time, what is quite important to understand is that the situation has not developed in the way President Putin imagined it when he started this war. Just probably 2 weeks before the war, we had been invited with my wife, friends and colleagues from the Institute for Human Sciences to discuss the essay that President Putin wrote in July last year about Russians and Ukrainians being the same people. And it was always my feeling in the last years is that the best way to understand President Putin is to read him literally. In a certain way, quite often he's doing what he's saying that he will do. And he really managed to convince himself that Russians and Ukrainians are the same people. He believes that they're going to be enough for special elite Russian forces to go to Kiev and to try to capture the government the governing buildings, and then the Ukrainians will go and meet the Russian soldiers in the way it happened in Crimea. I do believe this major miscalculation, totally misreading the sentiment of the Ukrainian people, was critical for everything that we're seeing now. And now Russia is trying to adjust to a situation which is very different than the one that they expected. Listen, we can make many parallels and we can talk history, and there are great historians commenting on this, but it's a classical colonial war. And from this point of view, also what the Ukrainians are doing in history, you have seen it many times. You have a small, newly born kind of a state which is ready to defend with a type of a heroism nobody expected. It's a totally different. The superiority of the Russian army was taken so much for granted that not only the Russians, but also the Americans were sure that Kiev is going to be fall down in a month. Now Russians should decide what they want. And one of the things is, President Putin needs a victory. So one of the possibilities is that we can end up with certain type of a peace settlement, and I can imagine that in his mind, the best day for this to happen is going to be May 9, the day of the Soviet victory over Nazi Germany. Because this war, particularly from the Russian side, is so much dressed in the rhetoric and the symbolism of the World War II, the great patriotic war for Soviet Union, that he will try to use this in order to claim victory.
Wie weit würde gehen für einen Sieg? How far do you think he would go for such a victory? And I'm thinking about the red button.
Listen, using the red button is not easy. It's much easier to talk nukes than to do nukes because there are certain things after which there is no reversal. At the moment, the biggest decisions that the Russian government should make is, are they ready, basically, to agree on a situation in which they're going to gain basically what they had before, namely try to get a tacit recognition of Crimea, moving their forces back to the borders of the Donetsk and Luhansk republics from the beginning of the war, and claiming that they managed basically to demilitarize Ukraine. But then they're not going to be able to claim that they have achieved their most important goal. In this essay that he wrote himself, every single word in this, in the summer of last year, President Putin said, I'm not going to tolerate, I'm not going to allow anti-Russia Ukraine. Listen, after this war, there is only one Ukraine that is possible, unfortunately, and this is anti-Russia Ukraine. So from this point of view, we are also ending a situation which, while we're going to have negotiations, while probably we can have ceasefire, peace settlement is not going to be easy for both sides. President Putin wants a victory. But President Zelensky is not ready to give him his victory because his people have been showing such type of resistance and heroism that the Ukrainian public opinion is not ready to give anything to the Russians. So the scenario that is very realistic but not necessarily extremely optimistic is much more something that we see in Korea for years. It is basically a frozen conflict that look like peace. You're going to see very much a divided Ukraine where basically you have a certain type of a peace settlement, but not a real peace. And all this is going to be negotiated. And of course, the negotiations are going to have different dynamics. And while one day we're going to have the feeling we are closer to the ceasefire, and the other it's not. But for some people that have left, it's not going to be where to come back. And this is also quite clear.
Sie haben gesagt, man müsse Putin beim Wort nehmen, man hätte ihn auch bei seinen Taten nehmen können. 2014 schon soll er die damalige deutsche Bundeskanzlerin Angela Merkel offen angelogen haben, als diese ihn gefragt habe, wer denn diese grünen Männchen seien, die jetzt plötzlich auf der Krim aufgetaucht sind. Und er meinte daraufhin offenbar, es seien unzufriedene Ukrainer. Und er, Putin, habe überhaupt gar kein Interesse daran, die Krim zu annektieren. Wir wissen, es kam anders. Trotzdem arbeiteten die Europäer weiter fleißig mit Putin zusammen. Sie bauten mit ihm eine neue Pipeline sogar, Nord Stream 2. Sie taten das sogar noch, als russische Bomber syrische Städte in Schutt und Asche legten. Wie kam es denn, dass der Westen trotz alledem in seiner Einschätzung der Person Putin und seiner Skrupellosigkeit so kolossal falsch gelegen ist? You said that Putin is not a liar. He basically he does whatever he says. But we could also have taken him by the way he did things. Back in 2014, when the then German Chancellor Angela Merkel asked Putin who these green men were that had suddenly appeared on the Crimea and whether he, Putin, was planning on annexing the peninsula, he is said to have answered that he was not, and that these green men were nothing but unhappy Ukrainians. Of course, they were not. We know what happened after that. Nevertheless, Europe kept on working with Vladimir Putin closely. Europe, especially Germany and Austria, decided even to build up a new pipeline, Nord Stream 2. They did not pull back even when Russian bombers did their job in Syria. How could the West, even though have so dramatically misunderstood what Putin is capable of?
Listen, you're absolutely right. On one level, he's literal. On the other, he's deceptive. He's a former intelligence officer. So his relations to truth is a particular one. But the story with President Putin and the way he was misread was very much based on the fact that at the end of the Cold War, Europeans, but also Americans, made one major mistake, not distinguish between three different things that happened at the same time. And we believe that they were the three same thing. It was not how the Russians viewed them. So it was the end of communism, the end of the Cold War, and the disintegration of the Soviet Union. Interestingly enough, very few people have been nostalgic for the end of communism. In a way, communism ended while communist party was still in power, with President Gorbachev being there. But one of the things that people didn't realize was that when President Gorbachev was very much negotiating with the West and trying to make Soviet Union part of the European liberal order in 1990, one of his major goals was to preserve the existence of the Soviet Union after the end of communism. So from this point of view, all this joining of European institutions, all these Paris charts and others were very important for the Soviet leadership because they wanted to keep the Soviet Union after the ideology that basically was legitimizing the Union was over. And he was not totally wrong to believe it. What people have forgotten was that in 1990, 1991, not anybody else but the President of the United States, Bush Sr., was asking Ukrainians not to get independent. And the fear was that at this moment there were four republics in the former Soviet Union and all of them have been nuclear. Russia, Belarus, Ukraine, Kazakhstan. So Europeans and Americans were so much traumatized by what they saw in Yugoslavia, starting basically in a kind of a dramatic and violent war. So they were very much trying to preserve the Soviet Union, and if not the Soviet Union, the Russian influence in a post-Soviet space. But people wanted to get independent. This is the problem. Politicians can decide many things, but then people go on the streets and no agreement can be kept. President Putin represents the part of the Russian elite that never reconciled himself to the disintegration, not of a Soviet Union as a communist state, but to the Soviet Union as a form of the Russian Empire. So all these years, when he's talking about the betrayal, and of course, listen, Russians has also legitimate points on certain security issues. It's not that everything that they're saying over these years was wrong. The problem is that even the right thing that they were saying cannot justify of what they're doing now. The problem is that he really believed that the countries that came out of the Soviet Union could not be sovereign in the way other countries in Europe could be. This was the other version of the limited sovereignty from the Brezhnev period, in which Russia should have a say, and Russia should dominate the politics and the economy of its neighbors. And look it, it's not only Ukraine. Before Ukraine, it was Georgia. There was a frozen conflict in Moldova. There was the Armenian Azerbaijan. So the post-Soviet space and the process of the disintegration of Soviet Union never ended. And here comes President Putin, who particularly after 2007 decided that he's going to rebuild not the Soviet Union, but the historic Russia. And here comes the biggest problem with the Ukrainians. Because in order for historic Russia to exist, he managed to convince himself that Ukrainians and Russians are the same people, and there is no country like Ukraine. So this is what we are seeing now, and this is what European leaders didn't see. Because for most of them, this type of a post-imperial period was over. Listen, many of the things that you see in the post-Soviet space are not things that Europe don't know. France in Algeria, 1960s, was not very different. Netherlands in Indonesia, but first it happens in Europe. Secondly, it happens to people with whom you share a language, a culture. And certainly it happens much later. So we were not ready to believe that he will risk everything in order by violence to try to reintegrate a place which have disintegrated and which I do believe here Europeans were right, cannot be reintegrated anymore. And from this point of view, we'll talk Ukraine, but one country was annexed in front of our eyes, and this was Belarus. Listen, 3-4 years ago, there was this authoritarian state, Belarus, that was run by a local autocrat, but he was trying to be sovereign in a certain way. Now Belarus is simply annexed of Russia. And from this point of view, these changes were happening in front of our eyes, but we were not ready to trust our eyes because we have a narrative about the direction in which the world goes, which did not fit of what we see.
Still, Ivan, when the Baltic states joined the NATO in 2004, Moscow was sending greeting notes. Als die baltischen Staaten 2004 der NATO beigetreten sind, da hat Moskau aber freundliche Willkommensgrüße geschickt.
We should be fair enough to say that even President Yeltsin was not particularly overexcited by the former Soviet republics joining NATO. And secondly, in the Russian political imagination, the Baltics were not really part of the Soviet Union. Don't forget, even It was a classical occupied states. Don't forget that the United States never recognized the Baltic republics during the Cold War as part of Soviet Union. But when it comes to Belarus, when it comes to Ukraine, even parts of Kazakhstan, this was kind of in the imagination not only of President Putin, but Mr. Solzhenitsyn has a very similar view of the fact that this is historic Russia, this basically is the Russian civilizational space, and it is a historical right of Russia to dominate this space. And nobody was interested what is the views of the Ukrainians, what is the view of Belarusians. Listen, 10 years ago, Ukrainians were the most Russia-friendly societies in the world. They have a very positive view of Russia. Many of them have a very positive view of President Putin. And the only thing that they wanted is basically to have their own choices. Because what is sovereignty? The possibility to choose. When basically Ukrainians started to make choices that Moscow did not like, suddenly everything starts to look like a threat. Suddenly Ukrainians disappeared, and Ukraine basically ended up, if you listen to the famous speech of President Putin from February 22nd, when he recognized the republics, he said Ukraine was created by Lenin, and three sentences later, it's populated by Nazi. So suddenly there was no Ukrainians anymore. It was basically state created by Lenin and populated by Nazi.
Herr Krastev, der 24. Februar hat auch das Leben eben dieser 45 Millionen Ukrainer auf den Kopf gestellt. Sie sind in einem halbwegs demokratischen Land mit halbwegs funktionierenden Institutionen ins Bett gegangen. Sie sind in einem Land ins Bett gegangen, das eine Ausrichtung nach Westen hatte, und sie sind mitten im Krieg aufgewacht. Millionen haben ihre Häuser verlassen. Binnenflüchtlinge, die es irgendwie über den Dnieper geschafft haben, in die Regionen in westlichen Ukraine, wo die Kampfhandlungen noch nicht so überschaubar, wo die Kampfhandlungen noch überschaubar sind, Betonung liegt auf noch. Mehr als 3,5 Millionen Menschen haben die Ukraine ganz verlassen, vor allem Frauen, Kinder und alte, erwachsene Männer unterliegen ja der Generalmobilmachung. 3,5 Millionen Menschen sind über die Grenze nach Europa gekommen, und dann ist etwas vielleicht Überraschendes passiert. Ausgerechnet die polnische und die ungarische Regierung waren diejenigen, die diese Vertriebenen mit offenen Armen aufgenommen haben. Etwas, was 2015 noch völlig undenkbar gewesen wäre, als Hunderttausende Afghanen, Syrer und Iraker nach Europa kamen. Waren Sie da überrascht? Mr. Krastev, the events of February 24 have marked the life of these 45 millions of Ukrainians. They had gone to bed in a reasonably democratic country with reasonably functioning institutions, aiming to head west. And they went to bed in their old routine, and they woke up in the middle of a war. Millions decided to leave their homes. They tried to get somehow to cross the Dnieper River, to get into those areas not yet affected by military actions, to Lviv and to Ushgorod. But more than 3.5 million Ukrainians decided to leave the country all together, mostly women, children and the elder, because men are under the general mobilization. And then something happened that might be a little bit of a surprise. Of all European governments, it was the Polish one and the Hungarian one that openly embraced the refugees, something unthinkable back in 2015 when hundreds of thousands of people from Iraq, from Afghanistan, from Syria tried to get into Europe. Have you been surprised by that?
Not to the extent that probably many of West Europeans have been surprised, because there is a major difference. People that have been coming from Ukraine was the people that both Poles and Hungarians basically knew. Even before the war, there was more than 1.5 million Ukrainians working in Poland. Secondly, unlike the war in Syria, and of course there is a part of ethnic issues, religious issues, all these kind of accusations for East Europeans treating different refugees differently is true. But there is three other things that explains what happens. And first is, this is the war that East Europeans understood. When basically Poles were seeing all these women and kids, and paradoxically cats, and I'm going to say something about cats and dogs, basically the pets crossing the border, they can easily imagine that if President Putin is not going to be stopped in Ukraine, then it's going to be them. It's going to be their cats and their kids going into the Western direction. When the war starts, something kind of a very powerful happens in all of our societies. Suddenly, before you can forget geography, you can forget history. You have the feeling that you're living in the world as a whole. And suddenly, history comes back. You start to remember films that you have never know that you're going to remember. Suddenly, you understand exactly how kilometers is between your house and the border which people are crossing. So this type of a level of solidarity was incredible because Poland or Hungary, on the level of institutions and organizations, they don't have this, for example, that I'm seeing in Austria or in Germany. But the level of volunteerism, the people who are going on the borders and with the car they're going to take the family and just putting them in their house, this was really amazing. And this was also really when you see how history is coming back and how you see, could we be the next one? But the second important story is the heroism of the Ukrainian men that have been fighting. Listen, the same people, if they have been crossing the border after Crimea or Donbass, are not going to be met the same way. Suddenly Europeans, and particularly Europeans, which for a long period of time during the COVID were seeing every death as unnatural and the only problem was how to stay alive and talking to each other, suddenly we saw a nation which is ready to die for its freedom. And this was this kind of also respect for the underdog. Seen from outside, they're fighting the war that they cannot win. But they're fighting. And they're fighting in the way that makes basically others to respect them. And this respect, in my view, also very much explains this solidarity. And the third, and there was a colleague of mine, famous Bulgarian artist, he's very much in the sphere of the visual, he told me, look at the cats, look at the dogs. People who are watching in Western Europe all this refugee flow, with their cats next to them, with their dogs next to them, they basically said, it could be us. And this feeling, it could be us, not it was our parents. Because when you see many of the refugees coming from Syria and others, even when you have empathy, you say, listen, this is how our parents have been living, this is how they have been crossing borders, suddenly believes, it could be my cat. And I do believe this feeling is something that is transforming Europe, and you ended up with things that are not easy to explain. It's not that European governments allied as a response to the shock. European public opinions allied. Do you know, according to the opinion polls, which is the society where the solidarity and support for Ukraine is strongest? Spain. Listen, there is no any political, economic, historical explanation why out of all countries Spain. And the reason is, and I don't know the explanation, but I know that in this kind of a war, different people are seeing different things. I can imagine that many Spaniards were seeing Spain in 1936. And they said they're like us. They have been left alone. They're fighting. It's not clear what they're going to succeed. I can imagine that many Catalans identified with the Ukrainians because they basically mistrusted the Spaniards. But these very important psychological changes, all these layers of memories that are coming, this is what is changing Europe in front of our eyes. And when you say that basically all countries and East Europeans have been very much together, one of the things that I read yesterday, I don't know, because I saw it on a tweet, the former president of the European Council, Donald Tusk, basically have tweeted it, the leaders of Slovakia, Czech Republic, and Poland decided to boycott the V4 group meeting in Budapest because they believe that Mr. Orban has took a pro-Russian line, which they're not going to support. Strangely enough, the V4 was born out of the migration crisis. And now suddenly it was destroyed by the Visegrad group of Central European countries, and it was destroyed not by the refugee flow because Hungary was taking it part, but by decision of Hungary not to allow to arm Ukraine and basically not to allow declaring that they're going to boycott any type of a sanctions on energy. So all the groupings, all the things that were so obvious to commentators, to analysts just yesterday, now suddenly look totally differently today.
Wir schauen mit großem Respekt auf diese Männer, die eben sagen, sie sterben für die Freiheit. Es gibt eine kleine Gegenbewegung, die sagt, das ist eine sinnlose, heroische Geste und es wäre doch besser, die Ukraine würde kapitulieren, um nicht noch mehr Blut zu vergießen. We look with a lot of respect on those men who say that they are dying for freedom, but there is a little intellectual counter-movement, if I may call it like this, saying it's a senseless, heroic act and it would be better if Ukraine capitulated in order to not to spoil any more blood. What would you say to them?
Listen, the movement of the peace sentiment, you're absolutely right. At some point, everybody said people should stop killing each other, and even we are not interested how it will stop. The problem is when. But all the states that you see in the world and all the identities have been built because of people who have been ready to die in the moment in which probably it was better to live. This is how nations are born. Charles Tilly, the famous sociologist, used to say, states make wars, but wars make states. Listen, Ukraine was quite messy, corrupt, dysfunctional. So before this war, the view of the people, even who were quite friendly towards the Ukrainians, were not particularly respectful towards the state of Ukraine. What Europeans knew was, of course, the beauty of Kiev and their friends, but also oligarchs, corruption. And suddenly you see people who obviously are ready to basically sacrifice a lot for being part of independent country. For Europe, it is a very strong sense and sentiment because we are living in a post-sacrifice society. We are living in a society in which the governments don't have the feeling that they have the right to demand of their citizens to sacrifice anything. So I do believe this kind of a difference is what is explaining part of it. When it comes when the war to start and so on, listen, we cannot decide on behalf of the Ukrainians. Neither we decide that they should fight, not that they should basically stop fighting. This is like people who are staying on the stadiums and believe that they're going to tell to the sportsmen how to behave. Only people who are taking the risk have the right to do it. And from this point of view, being more respectful to the choices that people are doing is very important, because for many of us, we have all these studios, we're going, we're talking, but we can go back home. And life is like this, that in 2 months, in 3 months, particularly if the war is going to be frozen, many of us will try to believe that we can go back to life as it was. What was the case with the Syrian war? But for people whose houses have been destroyed, whose relatives have been killed, this option is not there. And in my view, this is making the situation very asymmetrical.
Angesichts des russischen Einmarschs in die Ukraine hat die EU aber doch sehr geeint reagiert. Die Massenzustromrichtlinie, auf Deutsch ist das ein ganz ein furchtbares Wort, aber sie ermöglicht den Vertriebenen Zugang zur Gesundheitsversorgung, sofortigen Zugang zum Arbeitsmarkt. Die Vertriebenen können sich innerhalb der EU frei bewegen und die Kinder können in Schule oder Kindergarten gehen. Gleichzeitig hat die EU sehr scharfe Wirtschaftssanktionen erlassen. Gelder der russischen Zentralbank wurden eingefroren. Das Vermögen von Putin-nahen Oligarchen wird aufgespürt und eingezogen. Wie lange glauben Sie, dass diese europäische Einheitsfront halten wird? Und wo sehen Sie die Sollbruchstellen? In light of the current events, we have seen a surprisingly united Europe. The immediately put in place Council Directive, it's 2001/5050/EC, but the important thing is it guarantees a minimum standard for displaced Ukrainians in the EU. They are being taken care of when it comes to health insurance, when it comes to access to the labor market. They can freely move within the European Union, and their kids can attend school and kindergarten. The governments together have also put in place harsh sanctions against Russia. SWIFT is one of it, and they have frozen central bank assets. They are trying to seize property of Putin allies and the property of himself. But my question would be, how long do you think that this unity is going to last, and where are the rated breaking points?
Listen, this is a great question. Most of the things happened because the public opinion was highly vocal and highly radicalized. What is very difficult for us, even when we know the facts, is to try really to imagine how quickly Europe has changed. By the way, I'm also going to say something about Russia, how Russia changed in the last weeks. I'm sure that 1 month ago, even a week before the war, the German Chancellor Scholz was sure that if something is going to happen, there are going to be sanctions, but I'm sure that even he could not imagine that Europe and the United States were going to basically sanctions the currency reserves of the Russian Federation, basically sanctioning the Russian Central Bank. People are then discussing, is sanctioning SWIFT, cutting Russia from the SWIFT possible? Nobody imagined that it was possible to basically go and took more than the half of the Russian external reserves. What we are seeing now, discussing the possibility to move out of the Russian gas and oil, this was not in the cards. And then what happened? For a very short period of time, many things for which we basically have the feeling that we know how it looks like have dramatically changed. What we knew about Germany? We knew about Germany that Germans don't like wars, so nevertheless of what is happening, they're never going to arm. They're never basically going to increase their military budgets. And unlike Ukraine, probably you don't know, but there is no drones in Germany because Germans decided it's so unethical that they should not have drones. And suddenly, in a period of 48 hours, Germany decided not simply to start rearming Ukraine, but they decided to come with a special fund of 100 billion euro. And this was done by a government of the Social Democrats, of Greens, and the Liberals, the government that you least expect for this to happen. Then you have a country like Sweden, which for a period of a century was proud of its neutrality. And now this is one of the countries that is basically arming Ukraine more than most of the NATO member states. And just yesterday there was a statement of the German chancellor that Germany is ready to stand behind Ukraine, behind Sweden if it is going to be attacked. Then you saw all these East Europeans, which were famous for being anti-migrant, going by their cars. It was not just the decision of governments. Millions of people going to meet other people and to take them to their homes. This is a major change, and Russia changed a lot. Listen, because we see now, when we talk Russia, we see only Putin. But the story is suddenly, overnight, what happened is that many Russians were never interested in politics. They have been believing that Putin is bad, but they can live kind of next to him without being interested in him. They understood that for every person who go and protest on the street, he's risking 15 years in prison. And when people are asking me today, where are the Russians, why they are not protesting in millions, how many of us, if we know that they're going to be 15 years in prison, are going to go on the street? They lost everything. Their country is totally closed. They cannot travel. Many of them are leaving the country but not being sure that they can come back. So over a very short period of time, for so many people, the life changed dramatically. And this is why, for me, the most important is not to try to understand what is going to happen, because we'll never know what is going to happen, but try to realize what has happened already. And of course, you have a much more confrontation. You have Russia and China going much closer together than people expected. Suddenly, my daughter was asking me how probable is the use of nuclear weapons. Listen, it's not very probable, but it cannot be excluded. And what people are not talking about, but one of our colleagues in the Institute made very clear in a recent debate, there is a major risk of an accident in some of the Ukrainian nuclear power stations, because the Russian soldiers, which are basically now capturing these nuclear power stations, they have been probably trained how to kill and how to stay alive, but none of them was basically trained how to deal in a situation of nuclear equipment around. So all these things are changing the lives so much that I'm afraid, and this is an answer to your question, that after 100 days of war, people get tired. And some of them will believe, oh, this is awful that is happening. But if there are going to be some peace settlement, we can go back to normal. And then they're going to understand that the normal is not there anymore. Our life has very much changed. Economically has changed. Sanctions are going to hurt Europe. don't have doubts about this. In places like Germany and Austria, we can talk also about rationing of energy and gas and others. Because the problem of sanctions is not simply how much you can damage the other sides, but how much you're ready to endure pain in order to show that you want to achieve what you want to achieve. And this is a different world. This is my idea that it is before and after. And we're going to realize it step by step.
Sie sagten kürzlich, dass der Stärkere derjenige sei, der eben bereit ist, den Schmerz auszuhalten. You recently said that the one is going to win who endures the pain more strongly.
Yeah, this is true, because listen, we're living in a very interdependent world. Russia is a nuclear power. This is why it was very clear, and from this point of view, I do believe that the American president was right when he said we're not going to intervene militarily, because any American plane basically crossing the border, any NATO troops going into Ukraine, it means a type of a war that very easily can go to a total self-destruction of humanity. We're talking about the nuclear powers confronting each other. And unlike in the Cold War, when they're confronting each other, but in a certain way they knew very well their borders, we're in a totally different situation because we're much more interdependent. But then we're trading with each other, which was not much the case during the Cold War. We're meeting each other. All these Russian oligarchs, they have houses here. During basically the Cold War, Soviet leaders did not have houses in Vienna or in Paris. So suddenly you have all this, and also you have the internet, which means that we can try at least to pretend that we can talk directly to the Russians behind the back of their government, now much more different than before, but also Russians believe, Russian governments, that they can talk to every single Austrian through the Facebook and try to tell them what to do and what they want to achieve. So from this point of view, this is a much more dangerous world than the world of the Cold War. So from this point of view, comparisons with the Cold War is not there, and this is why the most important is resilience. And what is the resilience? The resilience is to be ready to pay the cost of your decisions if you believe that this is the way to defend your way of life. And this is a new situation, very new one.
Ist das eine Lektion, die Österreich und Deutschland, ich spreche da jetzt die Gasabhängigkeit an, noch lernen müssen? Is this something Germany and Austria, and I'm talking about gas dependency, not have learned yet?
No, listen, it's very difficult, and I have a huge sympathy also for the German, for the Austrian businesses, because from time to time we are not fair to these people, because it was our general view that the more you trade with somebody, the more secure the world is. So all these people who basically have been investing in Russia, they have been investing in Ukraine, they have been investing in China, they believe that this is how you are going to make war impossible. And now you understand that total energy dependence on a foreign country is becoming a problem, that basically this is a vulnerability, and there are going to be changes. And paradoxically, these changes is going to go to the every single consumer. It is going to affect everybody. Big companies in Germany and Austria, but also the small-sized companies. And then, of course, when you close the borders, all these rich Russians that basically were coming, and people can laugh at them, but they were great when they were staying in the restaurants and when basically they have been renting hotels even when they are not there. These people are disappearing. And what is interesting to happen is that we, all of us, have a lot of criticism to the world of yesterday. We didn't like this, we didn't like that. Suddenly, we're going to understand how good was the world that we are losing. And I really believe that Europe has two things to make. One is how to be resilient, but secondly, how to try to position itself in the world of tomorrow, which is not going to be the world of yesterday. And from this point of view, Europe is in a much more difficult position than anybody else, because the end of history was an American idea, but it was the European dream.
Jetzt hat der 24. Februar eben, wie Sie gesagt haben, das Ende einer Idee gebracht, nämlich die Idee, dass gegenseitiger Handel Vertrauen schafft, dass Länder, die zusammenarbeiten, sich nicht die Köpfe einschlagen, dass Wirtschaftsbeziehungen ein Sicherheitsnetz gegen militärische Angriffe knüpfen können. Es scheint vollkommen veraltet, dieses Konzept. Jetzt, der deutsche Soziologe Armin Nasehi hat die russische Invasion in der Ukraine ein Schisma genannt, eines zwischen Barbarei und Zivilisation. Was glauben Sie, auf welchen Prinzipien wird denn diese neue Welt, Sie haben sie gerade angesprochen, aufbauen. February 24th has proven wrong one fundamental idea, the idea that the world, an idea the world basically was founded on, the world we know, or we knew, the idea that common trade builds up trust, that countries that work together don't shoot at each other, that economical ties are a safety net against military actions. We know now that this concept is kind of crushed. It seems all to be over. The German thinker Armin Asehi called the Russian invasion in Ukraine a schism between civilization and barbarism. On which foundation do you think this new world that you have mentioned is going to build up on?
Listen, the future is the invasion of the unknown. One thing is for me clear. Europe believed that we're in an exceptional situation because the war was around us. And in the last 30 years after the end of the Cold War, there was many kind of a civil wars and many kind of a small conflicts in which the number of the people that have died was almost half of those who died during the World War II. But the story was that we were sure that Europeans were different. And now we discover that we are not. Now when we know that trade does not guarantee you peace, it does not mean that you should stop trading with others and that the only future for the world is basically people fighting each other. What I do believe is becoming much more important is to discovering what really our societies value so much that we are ready to defend on our cost, at any cost. And this is not about abstract ideas, but what are the things that we are afraid that we can lose overnight and then our life is going to be totally different. And from this point of view, this is the conversations that probably all of us are going to have with the Ukrainians who are running out of the war, the Russians who are running out of the war, because we have been taking for granted very much that the world has a logic, that this logic is economics, that everything is about institutions. At the end of the day, this is the moral choices of individuals and the responsibility of governments. And this is changing the world for us. I don't know, you're saying on what kind of foundation it is going to be built. I hope it's going to be built on a in a world in which you believe that the war is not the one that is basically help you to achieve your goals. But historian Tony Judd, whom I liked and we have been friends, he used to say that in the last 30 years we made one mistake. We have been talking a lot about the lessons of history, but we stopped to be interested in history. We stopped to understand why people were doing what they're doing. And as a result of it, 30 years, which started with never again, and now you have the feeling that it's never over.
Was ist die Lektion, die wir ziehen müssen aus diesem Einmarsch in der Ukraine? What is the lesson we have to learn?
For me, and then, I don't know, with the lessons, it's always difficult because the moment we learn one lesson, it turns to be that probably we should learn another one. But for me, the problem is that every generation should decide for itself really what is the meaning of life which they're ready to defend at any cost. And the idea that we believe that we can kind of skip this type of a major moral choices, and I do believe our generation has this feeling, turn out to be an illusion. It's never a situation in which you can basically simply living, believing that the war is not possible, that violence is not possible, that everything basically is going to be normality forever. And probably this is what we're learning. The life is fragile. And we should be ready for this.
Sie hörten ein Gespräch mit Ivan Krastev, das im Rahmen der Wiener Vorlesungen am 30. März 2022 aufgezeichnet wurde.
Sie hörten das Falterradio.